The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 36 of The Commentary Track, the most gruesome day in the calendar of the undead, when a headless corpse rides the cold night wind, when a woman's soul inhabits the body of a buzzing fly. And that's pretty much what's going to happen on today's show, give or take. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. We got a good one today. Documentary filmmaker Harrison Engel. I have admired Harrison for a great long time, and I think I gush appropriately throughout this interview, and have known him pretty well for a while, not as long as I would like to have, but he's a great guy and has really done some interesting things. So I believe that you will really enjoy what's going on here. I want to continue something I started last week, and I'm not doing this to toot my own horn, although I would if I could. I'm just not limber. But I really want to encourage everybody to go to iTunes and make a nice review and give me 5 stars and write a few words about why you love this commentary track more than you love life itself. I don't think that's too much to ask. Here's one that just was posted this past week, just a few days ago. And I'm going to read it in its entirety, and I do not know who posted it. It says FWT. I don't know who that is. So it's not anybody I paid to write, but I'm going to read what he or she says. And perhaps it's not too original to say, but if you love films, especially classic films, this is a must-listen-to podcast. Few people have breadth and depth of knowledge of film that Frank Thompson has. He's written several books, made a bunch of documentaries, etc. Few have the connections to get great guests, and fewer, zero, are doing anything with it. The interviews here are not like television talk show interviews. They're much more casual and way, way more informative. It's like two friends talking. Better, it's like two smart friends with interesting things to say on a topic you love talking. The guest list runs the gamut from directors to musicians to historians and much more. The conversation isn't focused on what the guest is selling because they're not selling anything. So it's free form, based on what the guest wants to talk about or what Frank wants to pick his, her brains about. Again, unlike a television talk show. So give it a shot. Look at the episode list and find a guest you're interested in or pick one at random. I think you'll be glad you did. Now come on, that's a good write-up. God bless that person, whoever wrote that. And even though I don't know who you are, I want to know who you are so I can give you a hearty hand clasp. That's good stuff. So please, I urge you to do that. I know I spend a lot of the fore and aft of this commentary track begging you to do stuff, but this is doing stuff that will not cost you a penny. All it is niceness to me and will help get this commentary track a larger audience. And if there's really the only way I'm going to ever reach world domination is if I get a larger audience. So give me a hand with that, and I'll spare you when I start taking over the world. That's my promise to you. In the meantime, let's go to our interview with the terrific, the great, the articulate, and the wonderful filmmaker, Harrison Engel. When you were a young movie lover, did you gravitate toward documentary films, or was that something that came along a little bit later?
Actually, documentaries came a bit later for me. I started making films when I was a teenager, really 14 and 15. I borrowed my dad's camera and went out and started shooting things. My first film, actually, though, was an animated film, a little 7-minute animated short and a little comedy routine. And I loved animation at first. And then I started making some other kinds of films, taking the camera out and shooting with it. And I sort of came of age during the widescreen revolution. And one of the first things I ended up doing was putting anamorphic lenses on an 8mm camera.
Wow.
And then mount the camera on my bike, and I would ride around and get sensationalistic shots, widescreen shots. And it was a lot of fun. And then I met a high school buddy of mine, Gerald McDermott, and he and I started making more structured films, quite apart from school, comedies and little war films and things like that. And actually, it was 6 or 7 years later that I made a first documentary with another colleague.
So you were making these films with him, just with your student, with your friend at school and that sort of thing?
Yes. In those days, there was no, film programs and things like that. You just gathered some friends together, went out to the park, wrote a scenario, and shot a movie. It was like early days of silent movies.
Hey, that's what Steven Spielberg did.
That's right, yes.
Start out with the friends.
Yeah, and I know his short films, and his are pretty terrific.
Do you still have any of yours?
I do indeed. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And I love them, and they're online. You know, nowadays they're on YouTube. So
wow, I should watch some of those.
Well, one of those, that one is called "Hello, My Baby," and it was made when I was a senior in high school, and it's a spoof of a 1920s or teens silent movie. We were very fortunate to have access to the Detroit Historical Museum, which had sort of a set, a 20s and teens set in there in the museum, and they let us go in there and shoot it there. So that was a...
Well, were you at all familiar with silent films at the time, or was it just a general thing that you kind of...
I think Chaplin and Keaton and some of the other silent era filmmakers, but this was before I really got my heavy duty film education. Just a little bit later.
Would you qualify yourself as a film buff in those days? Did you seek out movies, or were you just seeing the same kind of movies that everybody else was seeing?
No, I was a film buff. I correct myself to say that. I did see, now we're talking about 50s movies and early 60s movies. I liked biblical epics. I liked historical films. I liked the grandness of it, was appealing, full soundtracks. And I did seek out some foreign films, and that was during the beginnings of the foreign film invasion, where the first times you'd see Fellini or Bergman and so on. And so I was interested in...
Now, where were you living at this time?
Yes, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan.
Oh, okay.
And
so there must have been some theaters there that at least played...
Oh, yes. Yeah, and there were a few art houses and... Detroit in those days was not the decimated city it is now. It was actually had a thriving film theater system. There were many, many wonderful grand movie palaces in downtown Detroit that were all functioning at the top, and they were there was a whole theater dedicated to Cinerama films. There was the great Fox Theater, United Artists, Michigan, Palms, many, many of them, and then there were art houses at the time too. So I tried to see a lot, and I was curious. I like to be curious.
Every time I speak with someone who grew up in that sort of situation, I'm so envious, because I grew up in the rural South where there were no revivals, no foreign films of any kind. It wasn't until I went to college in Boston that I started being introduced to all this stuff. And it was like a miracle to me just when I first got there and could see almost anything.
Where did you move to then?
I was living in South Carolina when I grew up and moved to Boston. I went to college in Boston. So,
there was a lot
of movie
film
stuff
community
going
in Boston.
On there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, so you started making the student films or making films when you were a kid with your friends. And when did it kind of formalize into something that you really wanted to do for a living?
Well, actually, I think I would say pretty early. I went to Wayne State University in Detroit for undergraduate school, and I was making films there on my own, independent films. I made a little war film. I made a other comedy sketches with my friends and so on. And then during that time with a college friend, I made my first documentary. We did, and it was called Legacy. And that was finished while I was still an undergraduate. So, and that was a 18-minute documentary. It's on YouTube. And
what's it about?
It's about a farmer, a Canadian farmer sculptor, a man who had an apple orchard and was a Canadian farmer out in Goderich, Ontario, and he incurred financial losses and kind of retreated to his farm and became a sort of a primitive Grandma Moses-ish sculptor, and he would stick a pitchfork in the ground and put concrete around it and form a figure, and it turned out to be Winston Churchill or FDR or Maggie and Jiggs or all kinds of things, or dark visions of the dystopian future that he saw coming and so on. And my buddy Marvin Bernstein and I made this film, and it was shot 35mm. I shot it, edited it, and co-directed it, and Marvin produced it and co-directed it, and we sort of co-edited it too. So we worked hard on that, and we had hopes of getting that into movie theaters as a short, but it was a little too long and a little too somber, so it went in the closet for a while.
Well, where did you get all the equipment? I mean, how did you learn to edit and all that stuff?
Well, Detroit, actually, because of the auto industry, had a fairly thriving film community, believe it or not. And there were camera rental houses, equipment rental houses, and so on. And then I worked for the AV department at Wayne State at the time, and we would shoot all kinds of things. And it was really a wonderful lesson. And really, it was a it was better than film school. We made little social service films for social agencies in the city. A doctor would call up from the med school and say, I want to shoot a film about an operation I'm going to perform on a cadaver. And we would go down and film surgery on a cadaver. And we would go cover the football games. We'd, you know, shoot football games on film, 16mm. And all of that was just a tremendous learning experience about the tools. And they had gear that I was able to borrow and use. And they were very supportive and positive. And so,
wow, that's great. It's great to have access to that sort of stuff. I had my father's 8mm camera, but that was the extent of it.
Well, yeah, and as I say, my dad used to shoot home movies and handed me off the camera. My very first 8mm film was I took it to Ringling Brothers Circus, and I shot some footage of the sideshow and in the main tent and things like that when I was a kid. And now I'm talking about like when I'm 12 years old. So
sure.
Spielberg, by the way, also was influenced by the circus when he was a kid, as you know.
I think everybody was, and then everybody became disgusted with the circus at some point.
So, yes, so. We moved on.
Yes. Scared of clowns and then feel sorry for the animals.
Yes, that's right.
What's to like?
Another interesting thing, though, about those early days is that I was a performing magician. I was a boy magician.
I had no idea.
My name was Shandu the Boy Magician.
Yeah.
And I actually performed on television and at a legitimate theater. I performed with Harry Blackstone Sr., who was in his well in his 80s, and I was 14 or 15. So here I am on a stage in a theater in downtown Detroit performing, and I loved illusions and escapes and things like that. And I as you know, a lot of people, it seems, you know, who end up in the film business started out in the world of magic or were fascinated by the world of magic. So I guess I sort of fit in that mold, too.
That's fascinating. Did you teach yourself how to do these things, or Did you have a mentor of some kind?
No, it really was I would hang out at magic shops and at bookstores and go to the library and look things up and take some wood out in the back and try to build a rig to hold me upside down or find mm-hmm. a barrel that I could rig in a certain way so that I could escape from it and fool everybody. So
amazing. I'm still fascinated by magic. I love going to the magic castle. Or what I love is the close-up stuff, because that's what really baffles me. When you're in a big auditorium and there's flashes of smoke and all this stuff, I always had the feeling, oh, if I had enough money, I could buy that trick and learn how to do it.
Yeah.
But when you're sitting 3 feet away from somebody and the ball is floating out of his hand, then you're just, it's mesmerizing.
Yes.
Because it's still a trick, but it's, you know, what's going on?
Yeah.
So, well, I love that stuff.
Well, those magicians who perform, and especially at the Magic Castle, and they perform in the close up room and so on, they really are amazing pros. And they practice, and they have just mastered these tricks. And each one of those takes years to learn. And
did you ever see Ricky Jay in performance?
I've not seen him live, no. Yeah. I've seen him...
Mostly works with cards, but it's yeah. It's just mind-boggling, completely
yeah.
mind-boggling.
And yeah.
I never trust people who see a trick and then say, how did they do that?
Yeah.
Because I never want to know. Because it's obviously a trick.
Right.
And I never want to know how it's done, because... Then, oh, okay, if you do that, that happens.
yes. So when I was a kid, I went down to a hotel downtown and saw Cardini, the great Cardini, who was an English magician, perform.
Mm-hmm.
And Cardini was celebrated for, and I can't demonstrate it here, but he would take a deck in one hand and shuffle it through the air, let the cards
wow.
flip out through the air and land perfectly in his other hand. And it was just spectacular. And I went up to his hotel room. I called up, and he invited me up, and he said, kid, if you're interested in magic, get out of it. Don't go there. He was kind of maybe at a tough place in his life. But so I heeded his advice and moved on.
But this is, well, like Georges Méliès, yeah. you went from the magic stage to the cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what was the next step? How long did you stay in Detroit?
Well, I was in Detroit till I graduated from university. But I just want to mention that I attended a wonderful high school, which still exists, called Cass Technical High School. And that was sort of a fabulous curriculumed magic magnet school in Detroit, and you could go there and you could study automobile engineering, you could study refrigeration, could be your high school major, you could and I was a performing arts major, and so I studied stagecraft, I studied acting, I dance, you know, we built sets, we put on radio broadcasts and things like that. So that also was part of preparing me for the work, even though I didn't make films at Cass Tech. And I met my friend Gerald McDermott at Cass. He was an art major and an exceptional one. And so Lily Tomlin actually was a performing arts graduate from Cass or attended Cass for a while, yeah.
Roughly at your time?
Or she was a couple years ahead of me, two, three years ahead of me, yeah. So I didn't know her then, but we've since chatted about that, though.
Did you ever consider acting? I mean, if you were studying acting and dance and all that, did you consider performance?
I don't think I considered it professionally, but I studied acting enough at Cass and at Wayne State to be comfortable in that world. But no, I really saw myself as someone behind the camera.
Well, knowing all that helps you be a good director, too.
Yes, yes, yeah. Being a good director means knowing how, embracing all of these tools, you know, all the tools of cinema and all the tools of dealing with people and having empathy for other people. And so as a filmmaker, if I'm doing something dramatic, I really try to put myself in the shoes of every character in that story and empathize with them and sort of walk in their shoes. I think that's what a good director does.
Yeah. And some of your films have dramatic performances within a documentary framework. I mean, certainly The Indomitable Teddy Roosevelt, which, as you know, I revere. The acting in that is terrific. And it's better than, you know, I think the reason that I've always loved that film so much is that I get so annoyed by reenactments in documentaries. And it almost always really bothers me. And in this documentary that I'm just finishing up now, that's the lost remake of Beaugest, for those of you who want to pre-order. I really seriously considered doing some reenactments for it, but I simply didn't trust myself to do it right. And if I'd had the money, I just would have hired you to come in and direct the reenactments because you would have done it properly.
Well, but, thank you, Frank.
But that is one of the real miracles of that film, I think, is that the reenactments come bring the action to life in a realistic way as opposed to what I always call the walking up and down. You put people in costumes and they just walk around as the reenactments, and it doesn't do anything.
Yeah. Well, a lot of aesthetic and practical issues are raised by that. When I made The Indomitable Teddy Roosevelt, and actually a film archivist and historian, David Shepard, played a role in getting me started on that, and I just want to acknowledge David. David pointed out that there was a archive of wonderful Roosevelt footage at the Library of Congress that nobody had seen really in ages. And it had just been cataloged through a grant from NEH. So here was this pool of footage and people at the Library of Congress had gone through this footage and identified every figure in the footage and so on. So it was this wonderful resource suddenly came available, and I saw some of David's footage, and I said, "Boy, that is just fabulous!" And they're really it's time for someone to take a look at Roosevelt again. Nobody had it was the furthest thing from anybody's mind at the time. It was so strange to think that anybody would try to make a feature documentary about a dead president, president dead for decades. So that was just a special opportunity, but the footage had limitations, and there were big gaps in the footage, and they had to be supplemented some way to completely tell Roosevelt's story in a coherent way. So my reenactments were born of necessity, but I followed some strict guidelines, and I never let there be dialogue. I did limit it to, you know, forgive me, Frank, thank you for the good thoughts, but there is some pacing and, you know, some, I mean, it's tough to really create viable dramatic scenes and then inject them into a documentary. I had to be very careful and use those scenes fill a story, to make a story point, but not try to take over the film, you know. That was the to just keep the audience on track with the story. That's frankly, at that time, and now we're talking about 1982 and 3 when I made that film, long time ago now, no one was doing reenactments. That was 3 years, I believe, before The Thin Blue Line, which incorporated some reenactments and so on. I was kind of out there at that time in terms of mixing documentary footage and reenactments and stills and really trying to build a collage of a documentary.
And not everybody liked that, did they?
You got
a little bit of
No. I certainly took some heat for that at that time, and I understand it. I mean, I have not actually used reenactments frequently since. I mean, I understand.
Well, it worked perfectly there. I love that scene where they're getting their photograph taken, the Roosevelt family. And talk about some of the people who were there for that.
Yeah.
Or describe the scene a little bit so that people who haven't seen this, and everybody should see this movie. It's great. But talk a little bit about what that scene is and who was in it.
Yeah. Well, we had wonderful cooperation for these reenactments. I actually had several members, four or five members of the Roosevelt family, participating in the film in the reenactments. And for me, that made me comfortable with the idea, more comfortable with the idea. And we had Theodore Roosevelt V, for example, playing the boy Quentin Roosevelt, who was probably 5 or 6 at the time, and Theodore Roosevelt V was just a young boy, so he was playing his predecessor, and other Roosevelt, Pippi Roosevelt, and several others, and also John Gable, who ran the Roosevelt Association, played the photographer in that scene. Mm. And these scenes were as realistic as we could make them. That particular scene of taking a family photo was reenacted at Roosevelt's home, Sagamore Hill, on Long Island, and probably right where the photo was taken originally. In another scene from the film, The Indomitable Teddy Roosevelt depicts a scene from 1902, I think it is, when Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, is sworn in as president after the death of McKinley. President McKinley was shot and lingered, and then finally Roosevelt came to Buffalo, New York, and so I flew up to Buffalo with a small crew, and we filmed on the physical spot where Roosevelt was sworn in. And so I was, trying to be as historically accurate, mm-hmm. even though we were doing reenactments and so on, as accurate as possible.
Well, it worked out splendidly, and I think one of the real treasures of that film, too, is the soundtrack. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, thank you. Yes, I'm very proud of that soundtrack. At the time I was making it, I had taken my family to a concert at the Hollywood Bowl, and it was a 4th of July concert, and they were playing a lot of Sousa music. And I thought, my goodness, how terrific this is. Here's this 20,000 people at the Hollywood Bowl, and they're all having the time of their life. And listen to all this wonderful, a little bit bombastic, but wonderful Sousa mm-hmm. music. That started me thinking about That kind of fed into the thinking about the documentary, and I thought, gosh, wouldn't it be interesting to make a documentary that is as alive as a band concert would be? And it was sort of my looking for a different approach to a documentary, not a straight ahead documentary. That film, by the way, I'm very just to digress for one sec. I'm very proud of the fact that that documentary, which is a 93-minute film, has not one talking head in it. Mm. Nobody's on camera talking, and it has exquisite narration and several voices, and the narrative voice of George C. Scott. So it has many strengths, but no talking heads, no experts. Now, about the music, I ended up recording with a 55-man concert band in Detroit, a complete score almost entirely made up of Sousa music from the suites, operettas, and of course the marches of John Philip Sousa. And while I was doing my research on the film, that film had a very slow gestation. It took several years to get it funded and going, and I came to really see that Sousa had written a score for this film. I mean, he wrote he was a contemporary of Roosevelt's, and so when Roosevelt sent the Great White Fleet around the world to show off America's military might, Sousa wrote a march about it. When Roosevelt went to the Panama Canal to see what was going on there, Sousa wrote a march about it. When Roosevelt's son died in World War One during World War One, Sousa wrote a memorial piece about it. And so, really, Sousa, in a remarkable way, mirrored Roosevelt's story. And so I ended up with a 72-minute score out of a 93-minute film.
Wow.
And it's wonderful. And that score has it's actually on its own separate CD now with the film.
I have it in my iPod right now. I certainly played a lot of Sousa marches in my high school band and so forth, and knew a lot of his work, but I don't think I had ever really registered how versatile he was as a composer until I watched that film, and he really does go all across the board. I mean, I'd seen the film Stars and Stripes Forever with Clifton Webb, and they show some of the operatic things that he wrote and some other things, but it still didn't really sink into me just how far afield he went in what he composed.
Yeah, these days people don't know the operettas. He had operettas on Broadway, you know, at when he was alive, and so those films are those that music is much of it's largely forgotten. But as I did my research on the film and listened to the music, and there are only a few recordings of many of his pieces, his compositions, I began to sort of piece together this very complex puzzle where, oh, that's a very interesting piece of music, and really to sort of understand it, understand the context of that music, and then how it would fit appropriately in my film. So it took a long time. And actually, it was a good thing that the film took years. I worked 8 years on that one film, and it's a good thing that it took a long time, because it gave me time to really reflect on it and to keep building on it and until I was finally done.
In one way, I envy you. The documentary that I keep saying I'm just finishing it up. God knows if I'm finishing it up. You know, it's like I expected it to be out last August, and so it's still not finished.
It's a work in progress.
But the good part about that is, and maybe one of the reasons that it just keeps going on, is that you do keep having more ideas, and you keep watching and you think, wow, I could redo this. And if you just had time and money, you could make splendid things all the time, I guess.
But right.
I have neither for this case.
It took me 4 or 5 years just to find the money to make that film. And it was one of the toughest. Making the film was one of the hardest things I ever did in my life, if not the hardest project I ever worked on. And it's kind of a small miracle that that I got the project funded, that I was able to execute it to the extent that I was, and then once we finished it, it took 3 years to get the film shown on television. And when we did get it shown on television, it played on ABC in prime time, sponsored by AT&T on Sunday night.
That's almost unbelievable in itself.
That really was kind of a miracle.
And
then it's played on A&E and also on the History Channel. And then it's now in its fifth video incarnation.
Wow.
So pretty unusual for a documentary filmmaker to go through all that, and I was just, hung in there.
How did you get George C. Scott involved?
Well, the narration for The Indomitable Teddy Roosevelt was written by a wonderful writer named Theodore Strauss. Ted Strauss was a writer for David Wolper and some of the prestigious films that Wolper had written. Ted also had been a film critic for the New York Times, wrote 200 plus reviews, film reviews for the New York Times. He was a novelist. At one time, he was head of the story department at 20th Century Fox. He's a very interesting man. And Ted wrote a wonderful narrative script for kind of lofty and just had a different sound to it from what one might call typical documentary-style writing. I sent this script to George Scott, who at that time had just made Patton and a couple of other things. And he read it. He loved it. He wanted to do it. And he was perfect for it. I mean, we didn't imagine anyone else. And
he was a TR buff, too, wasn't he?
He was a TR buff, yes. Scott knew history, he knew it was a terrific match, you know. And so I was so fortunate to get him to work on
that's
the film.
That's great. Yeah. I think why I hold that film in such high regard is that really everything came together. As difficult as it was for you to do it, all those different elements, because the narration is spectacularly good. I couldn't write anything like that. It's wonderful. And then to have such a perfect voice speaking the narration and that perfect music with an unexpected music. It's surprising music because you don't go in thinking that there's going to be this range of emotion in the music of who you just think of it for his marches. That's all.
Right.
And then the reenactments and all that stuff, it just comes together. It came out in a 3-disc box set, a couple of years ago, maybe?
Yeah, right.
So that's the thing to get.
That's still around. You can buy it on Amazon and elsewhere. It's a nice, and I do an interview on it, and there's some historical information about Roosevelt and so on.
Yeah, and a separate disc just for the music, which is great. Yeah. So we jumped out of chronology a little bit, but I don't care. When did you come to Hollywood?
After Detroit, I moved to New York City, and I got a degree in film, a master's in film at Columbia University, and I worked for some wonderful filmmakers there in New York Willard Van Dyke was one, a very well-known documentary maker from the 30s and 40s. I worked for Willard for a couple of years, and then I worked for Francis Thompson, another wonderfully talented filmmaker.
With a great name.
Yeah. But life in New York was also tough. I was a freelance cameraman and editor, still making my own films of various kinds. I made a short comedy while I was in New York called Railroaded, and I hired Philip Glass to write the score for it.
Wow.
Philip at the time was driving a taxi in New York, but he wrote a wonderful score for that film, too.
And that was his first score, right?
It was one of them. I don't know if it was the very first, but yeah, we were all...
Let's say it was.
Yes. Yeah, we were young and eager to get out there. But one day I got a notice check in with a friend at the American Film Institute in Washington. They were making a film for the American Bicentennial. So this is in the 1970s, 76. I was hired by AFI to move from New York to Washington. And then eventually, as that project evolved, they moved me to Los Angeles. So my family and I, moved out to continue with that film. That film was called America at the Movies.
It
was a 2-hour compilation film for the American Bicentennial with clips from, I think, about 115 movies, and quite an unusual compilation feature film because it had Modern Times and 2001 and Casablanca and White Heat and all kinds of movies that wouldn't normally be mixed together. So it was quite an ambitious project, and I worked on that for 2 or 3 years.
I had no idea it would take that long to do. Of course, it must have been even more complicated in those days to get prints of everything and
Yes.
the physical editing of it and everything.
Editing, the process was so different in those days. And we brought in so my offices at that – by this time in the mid-70s were at Greystone in Beverly Hills and in the stables.
Was it already an AFI building at the time?
Yeah. AFI had taken over Greystone for a few years, for a decade or so there. And funny story is that David Lynch was living in the stables working on Eraserhead and locking himself in at night. And finally, George Stevens Jr. called him up and said, "David, you've got to move out. I need a space for this film." And so David moved out and I moved in to the stables, and we turned it into a proper editing facility. And eventually we brought in 450 35mm prints to make that film. And if you just think about the amount of, you know, the weight of that, the volume of that, it was huge. It was a huge project. So it was very cumbersome in those days when you were dealing with film completely.
Yeah. And that's the sort of film that it hurts my head just to think about the logistics of putting that together, because I don't know if you write the script first or if you write the script last. I don't know if you just outline it and try to figure out where all the what your basic plot points are going to be, or it just seems I get tired just thinking about it.
Well, it was a very hard film because there wasn't really a natural structure to it, and we outlined it. We broke the subject, the topic, into five sections, tried to create each of those. But it was a time consuming, exhausting process, ultimately, in some ways, we did not succeed. You know, it's really difficult to embody our whole country with all of these disparate films, moments from all of these disparate films, and still give it a coherence and a look and so on. But we were pleased with it at the time.
It had been tried once before in 1939 with a film called Land of Liberty. Did you ever see that?
That's right. And we did look at Land of Liberty, which didn't work either. No. But we succeeded a lot more.
I remember being very impressed with that when I saw it.
It had its
strengths.
I'm
glad that you showed a clip from John Wayne's The Alamo.
Absolutely. We had clips from all sorts of
things. As long as you had that in it, I was okay with everything else.
Well, ultimately, I mean, we had various sections. I was the associate producer, the line producer on that film. I wasn't – it really was directed by George Stevens Jr., who was the chief executive at AFI at the time. We had a team of an editing team and so on, and that I headed. So, but we had five sections, and I don't remember them all. But the land, the people, the spirit, and so on. Mm-hmm. And so, very easily, one could say, "Well, why do you put the spirit of St. Louis in? You know, why isn't that in with the people, or you know, or in the cities?" And so, you know, you could quarrel with all of these decisions, but we thought it was an entertaining film.
It is one. I would like to see it again. I haven't seen it in years. So
yeah,
You worked with George Stevens Jr. again on the Was it again? I guess that was after the film he made about his father, George Stevens, A Filmmaker's Journey. Were you just a cinematographer? Did you work in any other capacity on that?
No, but I worked with George Stevens Jr. for a few years after the America at the Movies experience. One of them was to help him make this film about his father, and I was only involved. I shot all of the stills that are in that film. And literally on the wall in my living room with a Panavision camera.
So did you do all this pans yourself and all that stuff?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And as I had done with the Teddy Roosevelt film. But also I had a subsequent phase of my career. I went on to work on three of the early AFI Life Achievement Award programs, including tributes to Henry Fonda, Jimmy Stewart, and Alfred Hitchcock. And I put together 40 minutes of wonderful clips from the Hitchcock films for that amazing event, which was really Hitchcock's last hurrah in Hollywood before he passed away.
He looked very ill in that.
He was very ill in that show. He was inebriated. He'd been upstairs having a little too much to drink. He was in pain because of his knees and had trouble walking and so on. So it was a heartbreaking evening, actually, in many ways. One thing that's kind of amusing about that is that during the afternoon of the day of the show, Hitchcock came down from his hotel room upstairs in the Beverly Hilton Hotel to the ballroom and to check out his cue cards, and he read his little acceptance speech. And I think Marty Pesetta was directing that tape show, and we thought, well, gosh, you know, let's roll this, you know. And so they taped Hitchcock reading his acceptance speech off of cue cards that he had to stand up to look at. And then that evening, when it came time for his to actually do the acceptance, give the acceptance speech, he was not able to stand up. He had maybe had a little much to drink and was tired and was uncomfortable. So we ended up using the afternoon rehearsal tape in the show, and it cuts in pretty well. But if you look at it, you'll see that he's not wearing the same outfit and so on.
Yeah, those early years of the AFI Life Achievement Awards, they were really giving people who had a life achievement.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And, they were pretty interesting. They were really the top of the cream of the Hollywood greats.
And some of them they got at the very last minute. I mean, John Ford, too, who was also not looking his best. And
no.
So those are valuable things.
Those were exciting years, and all those shows were a lot of fun to work on, and they were very difficult to produce because of the film montages and so on, where all had to be done physically.
Sure.
An amusing story about that is that one year William Wyler was given the award, and the film did not show up from the lab for the dinner, and everyone in Hollywood was in the ballroom, the grand ballroom, and suddenly they had to run the work print that year. And so I got brought in the next year, so to do it right. Let's see,
So that was each one of those is like a little mini repeat of the 1976.
Yeah. They were working with archive footage, with great films and. And creative editing, I think, is what you would say. And so I got pigeonholed in that area. I mean, I enjoyed it. I love it. I love films and film history and working in the archives and then shaping that material creatively. But I had other interests too.
Sure.
But that's the kind of work I did for a lot of times. Subsequently, I've done film tributes for 7 Oscar shows, including Billy Wilder and Barbara Stanwyck and some pretty amazing people that I had an honor to work with. George Lucas and Spielberg narrated that one. And
now, did you ever get to have interaction with those people when?
Yeah. I would always meet them.
Yeah.
And often I got to know Billy Wilder a little bit, who was such a sweet man, and I'd go over to the apartment, and he'd give me a stack of his photos, and I'd take them back to the office and work with him, and so on. And I went over to Spielberg's office to record him. You know, he narrated the tribute I did to George Lucas, and so. So yeah, I know them a bit.
That's right.
And I also met in those years Robert Wise, who was a wonderful, wonderful man.
Oh yeah, I knew him well.
A wonderful director and a mentor to many and many of us. And he was
one of the best in terms of being a nice person, a good person.
Yeah.
I don't think you'll ever hear a word against him as a human or as a director.
Yeah. I like that part of Bob. Yeah. You know, he was invariably gracious and kind and giving, but he could also be tough on a set. He could be tough.
I'm sure he could, yeah.
And he didn't make 40 movies, you know, by being too nice. I mean, he had to get the work done.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I interviewed him many times, wrote a book about him, and I remember the first time I ever wrote to him, just out of the blue, I had the idea to do an article about The Haunting, which is a movie I'd always loved, and just wrote to him, and I was living in Pennsylvania at the time, and I said, you know, I'd love to interview you about The Haunting. Could we do a phoner or something like that? He wrote back and he said, hey, I'm going to be in New York, staying at my club. Why don't you just, that's not far from where you are, right? And I said, yeah, I can get there. So I said, come on into my club and we'll just come to my room and we'll talk there. So spent all day there, had dinner. We talked about the Haunting for like 4 hours.
Oh my gosh.
And it was just great, just great. So when I finally moved into doing the book about him, it was like, you know, we'd already spent quality time together, it worked. But he was a terrific guy.
Yeah. Obviously a creative and brilliant filmmaker and.
You had editing in common with him, too.
Yes, indeed. We kind of came up through the editing route, at least in one sense. And it was my sad privilege that when Bob died, I was able to put together a memorial tribute, a 20-minute memorial tribute called Robert Wise in His Own Words, and to take a number of interviews that Bob had given over the years and fashion those into a memorial tribute with the clips from his films and so on. And
these, that's great.
And so I owed that to him, and I was honored to do it.
Back when he was an editor, it was a normal – well, I'll preface this with saying one of the differences between Hollywood then and Hollywood now is that there doesn't seem to be a career track now. It used to be that you could start off being an office boy, working in the mailroom, then you become an editor, assistant editor, then an editor – then, hey, I want to be a director. So you just keep moving up. But it seems like now whatever job you get is the job that people think of you as forever.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that with your own career in that it's almost like editing became your bread and butter job and then documentary filmmaking, which I know from talking to lots of documentary filmmakers is not the way to become a mega millionaire. So, it's not like the editing led to something else. Editing just kind of remained your bread and butter, right?
Yes, right. And I worked on many projects as an editor, but also as a cinematographer too. Mm-hmm. And I keep pushing forward and I always tried to keep going with my own personal projects as well.
Wanted to ask about the Vertigo film, which I just rewatched yesterday, and which I enjoy very much. And commentary track guest Joe McBride was one of the contributors to that.
Yeah,
he's listed as co-producer. I have a feeling he might have written the script too. But
yes,
and I'm guessing that there was a reason that he called himself a co-producer or whatever it's called.
Well, yes. I mean, we this little documentary, in those days when I made that show called Obsessed with Vertigo, there were issues, WGA issues and so on. And Joe did basically write that program and wrote a wonderful narration script for it. And Joe certainly... Joseph McBride certainly knows his Hitchcock and knows his film history and so on. And so it was a pleasure to work with Joe on that. And
he's a great guy.
He's a great guy and, of course, a specialist in John Ford, of course.
Yeah.
And
knows his stuff.
Knows his stuff, yeah. I do want to tell you a little bit about the Vertigo film. After doing the AFI Hitchcock tribute, I sort of became a bit of a specialist in Hitchcock. When Universal acquired five features from Hitchcock that he had owned personally and that had been out of distribution for a while, Rear Window and Rope and The Man Who Knew Too Much and The Trouble with Harry and Vertigo, I put together a trailer for all five films, advertising five films. It was put out in the theaters, and Jimmy Stewart came and narrated that for me, and
nice.
it played around, and so it was a wonderful and
this is the mid '80s, right?
Yeah, this is in the mid '80s,
something
right?
Like that?
Right, and I had been always in love back in my Detroit days when I was in high school and I first saw Vertigo. I'd been just knocked out by that film. I thought, my goodness, what an amazing movie. And it, as it turns out, back in that summer, just a month or two after the film came out, I ended up traveling to San Francisco with some friends from high school. And I went to all of the sites. Mm-hmm. So I probably am the first pilgrim to those sites way, way, way back then. And so it was a special honor to make a film about Vertigo. And I knew Jim Katz and Bob Harris, who were working for Universal at the time and who restored the film. At the time, and in using film technology,
that was a nice structural decision you made to intercut their restoration efforts with reminiscences of making the film.
Yeah,
it's almost like it goes from one to the other, and then back and forth, and it's a nice balance there.
Well, I tried to. As I try to do with every film, dramatic or documentary, I try to find a tone, a style for the film. And in this case, with that program, I wanted to treat the story as a suspense film. That is to say, I wanted to make a suspenseful documentary, a film that had a lot of the music and the style, almost as though it was part of the feature film, or it was a child of the feature film. So by using the Bernard Herrmann score also in my program and so on, these were things that weren't always done. And this was sort of an early making of film, but I tried to put myself back at that time when Hitch was making the film.
Yeah, it's a really nice film. You have a lot of the major players in it. And,
yeah,
Kim Novak. That's the real get of that.
Yeah, Jimmy Stewart had passed away by then, and Hitchcock was gone. But I did get Peggy Robertson, who was his assistant on the picture. Script supervisor, I believe, and Barbara Bel Geddes,
and the screenwriter,
it was
Pat Hitchcock,
and Pat Hitchcock, yeah. Yes, indeed, and Roddy McDowall, even though he wasn't connected with the project, was English and knew Hitch, and
his voice fit,
his voice fit perfectly, yes, right.
Um,
I still would love to make a feature film with the same kind of told with the same level of first-person storytelling, quiet and suspenseful and romantic. I still love those aspects in films, and I still want to make a feature film like that.
Well, how much of a stab have you ever made at making a dramatic feature film? Or has that ever been a real ambition or something that you've gone after?
Well, I've been involved in two features on a major level. One was a film called DA. It's adapted from a off-Broadway play by that name, by Hugh Leonard, an Irish playwright. And that feature was made in the late 80s, and I was a production executive on that film. I was sent over by the producer of the film, Sam Grogg, to Ireland to oversee the film. And so I really was on set pretty much throughout that film, and in a quiet way influenced the making of it. I wasn't the director of the film, but I was there on behalf of the producer, and it was a wonderful adventure to make that film. And Martin Sheen stars in that film, and mm-hmm. Bernard Hughes, who was a wonderful actor yeah. from Broadway, Irish actor. And so it was wonderful to be in and around Dublin at Ardmore Studios, where we shot. And we inherited the crew from My Left Foot. And so we had some wonderful people working over there, wonderful new cinematographer and a new director, Matt Clark. Then another film that I directed was also for Sam Grogg, who was a wonderful independent educator, but also filmmaker at that time. And Sam brought me in to direct a feature film in North Carolina called The Legend of Toupath.
Ah.
And this was a historical, small-scale historic epic about the English settlers arriving in America in about 1610 or so. And it basically is the what's called the Lost Colony story. If you know your North Carolina history.
And I do.
English settlers came to North Carolina. They landed approximately at Roanoke sure. Island on the Atlantic coast. And they the man who spearheaded that expedition, this was the first time Europeans had landed formally in North America. And the colony, there were about 40 to 60, I think, ended up being stranded there. John White, who spearheaded the expedition, had to go back to get more provisions back to England, basically left this colony there, and he didn't return until 3 years later, and by then the colony was gone. It had disappeared, and nobody to this day really knows exactly what happened. So this is a famous story in North Carolina lore. What this film, The Legend of Toupath, attempted to do was tell that story from the Native American point of view in terms of three local tribes. They were all part of the Algonquin tribes, I guess, or nations in that area, and what happened to them with the arrival of these settlers. And so it attempted in a light way to be informative and to just present a different alternative.
A terrific film.
Well,
I think I remember the first time I saw it, which was right after I first met you. There's got to be at some sort of conference out in Woodland Hills or somewhere.
Yes.
And
film on history or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And I just finished my Lincoln book then. They put copies in the gift shop or whatever they were calling it. Not only did I not sell any, but somebody stole a copy. So that was my memory of that. Luckily, I met you, and that was a balancing thing.
Made up for
and
it.
I first saw the Teddy Roosevelt film. But soon after that, you told me about The Legend of Toupath, and I put it in the the player thinking that it was going to be a documentary. I don't know why. I just assumed it would be a documentary, but it wasn't, and it was right. good.
Well,
and of course, it's a period of history that I'm really fascinated by, and you know, I thought it captured that place in time very, very nicely.
Well, beautifully shot. Again, it's a difficult kind of subject matter to pull off. First of all, we're dealing about with long ago history. We did not have a large budget, a couple million dollars, and the film, we had to import Native Americans from Canada for the leads because there really isn't a large Native you know, community here of with real acting chops, you know, and so many Native Americans, as we say, live in Canada and work in North America. I mean, they commute back and forth. Mm-hmm. They have dual citizenship and or working privileges. So we went to Edmonton, Alberta to cast our leads, and then we flew them to North Carolina, and then we brought some of the Native cast from Los Angeles, and we found some locally. But you know, if you live in North Carolina, you have a North Carolina accent, and it's very, and then, but you're dealing with, you know, historical figures and so on.
Sure.
So managing all of those aspects, and trying to get a coherent look and style to the film it was not easy, but I do think that we accomplished a lot with that film. We designed a whole Native village. We built the village. We burned it to the ground. We had kids and horses, I mean, animals and water and fire and all the things that you're not supposed to deal with in your films, you know, to pull them off. And we worked very hard. We had a wonderful crew and a wonderful cinematographer, Dennis Maloney. And we had to manufacture all the costumes. Design and manufacture them because nobody has, you know, costumes from 1610, what natives wore at that time is all different. So build all sorts of design and construct. So it's quite an ambitious project.
Now, did you film it pretty close to Roanoke or at Roanoke?
Well, most of it was filmed on Roanoke Island or close by in North Carolina. And then the project was produced through the North Carolina School of the Arts. And they actually have that film school, their film school, is quite a substantial school, and they have several large stages there, and they have a lot of trucks and camera gear and so on. And so we were able to shoot interiors on the stages at North Carolina School of the Arts, and they were great. The people, the students, film students there would come in as second and third ADs and you know, work in various departments. So we really had a pretty terrific, you know, cast and crew.
North Carolina is really a significant filmmaking state.
Yeah, that's right.
It's surprising how busy it is and how much they're making features there all the time.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Lots of TV.
Yeah. And it's just this feature, the Legend of Toupath, was made in 1996, and indeed they had already had some wonderful films made there. But since then, too, they've been had an awful lot of production.
Yeah. Well, we should probably be wrapping up, but I wanted to ask you what might sound like a complete non sequitur, but did you ever know Les Blank?
I know Les Blank, but I've never worked with Les. But you know, I wrote a little bit about him recently, and
he passed away today.
I didn't know that.
Oh
my gosh!
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did.
I did not. Yeah. I knew he was ill
this very day. Yeah,
and I'm quoted in the new DGA magazine, commenting about Les. Les was a wonderful filmmaker, and his quirky, very personal, but very human and and Wise films always touched me. But I thought he was a good craftsman too, and I mm-hmm. and I said some things for the Directors Guild magazine because about that, because he the shooting was always great. I mean, he was one of these guys I know less in the sense that he and I both learned to shoot, and, you know, we're complete filmmakers, you know. We know how to shoot them, and then we take the footage into the cutting room and cut it, and we then we narrate it, and, you know all that, you wear all those hats, and that's what Les did. And his films have terrific shots. They actually, what I wrote was about just, if you look at a Les Blank film, there's a certain shot structure in there, and so he's really a pro, and I didn't want people just to think of him as just shooting something in a quirky way and so on. No, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, he was definitely one of those documentary filmmakers who was able to make have a personal impact on the style of what he did. And there aren't a lot of those. I mean, he's
right.
One. Errol Morris is one.
Yes, right.
Yeah, I guess you could argue that Michael Moore is one.
Yeah.
But Les Blank is somebody I always thought a lot of, so I've been thinking about him today.
Well, I admired him. We were in the American Film Showcase program last year together, and I'm sorry to hear that Les had passed. Yeah,
yeah, I was sorry to learn of it just before I came over here. So it was. I thought, well, I want to be talking with a documentary filmmaker, so I'll,
right.
I figured you must have crossed paths at some point. What are you working on? Have you got something in the hopper?
Two projects in the hopper, but it's a little early to talk about them.
Okay.
But one of them is a feature documentary, and the other is a involving the film industry, let's say. And the other is a feature, ultra low budget feature, and I'm hopeful for both of them. And
nice,
we will see.
Okay. Well, then I come back for part two of this interview when those have been
absolutely.
Made. Great. It's been a great pleasure, Harrison.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's wonderful to be on your podcast.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Harrison Engel. I love talking to Harrison, and we have talked several times since we recorded this podcast. Always great fun. I am a little sheepish about one thing. I had just heard that morning about the death of Les Blank, and for whatever reason, it occurred to me that as a documentary filmmaker, Harrison would have an opinion about Les Blank, but I don't know why in my thick skull it never occurred to me that he would actually know him and would be shocked to learn of his death. So I just blithely just jumped right in there, "Hey, Les Blank is dead. What do you think?" And I sounded like a boor and a cretin and I just felt terrible about it. Although Harrison rallied pretty well, got through it okay, and so I'm just beating myself up a little bit about how cavalier I was about that. You never want to hear about the death of someone that you know and admire in such a flippant way, and I feel like I just kind of tossed that off. So, forgive me, listeners, and don't go on iTunes and say, "He's a boor." Don't do that. It would only hurt me, and I'm hurt enough already. I'm harder on myself than you could ever be. Okay, I know that's not true, but I hope you'll believe it. I want to thank my wife, Claire McCullough Thompson, for being my wonderful announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. Go to both of them, won't you? Buy my books, buy my videos. Use the Amazon links for whatever you buy. And face it, you're going to use Amazon because Amazon has everything in the world. You can't buy anything that's not on Amazon. So I urge you to buy a Pacific Island on Amazon, and I will get a kickback worthy of the name kickback. But even if you just buy books or DVDs or what have you, I'll get a little bit of a kickback, and that I would be most grateful for. I also, of course, want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for my wonderful theme music. I love listening to it each and every week, never get tired of it, and I hope you don't either, because it's lovely stuff. So, we will be back next week with Mac Senate Authority Brent Walker, and that was a fun interview that was less than 24 hours ago, and I enjoyed it very much, and I know that you will too. So come back enjoy some more movie talk. And in the meantime, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.